coming. Thank you, Sarah, so much. Well, it's wonderful to see you all. Just put up a hand if you came yesterday. Oh, lots of you come back. Wonderful. Anyone, this is your first time? A few. Lovely. I'm going to do a very brief recap of what we looked at yesterday, little introduction, and then we're going to be looking at some new things. But first, just to highlight a couple of books. So this book, Left to Their Own Devices, is really what this seminar is based on. I wrote it back in 2017. This is a brand new edition, fourth edition, just came out last month, that has up-to-date stats. It's got a new chapter on AI. And so obviously we're going to cover as much as we can in these two sessions. But if you want to just go and grab one from the bookshop, that's got more information in. So that's that one, Left to Their Own Devices. And then one that I wrote that goes with it is called A Mind of Their Own. This is building your child's emotional well-being in a fast-changing world. It's what are the things that we can do upstream that will help build emotional well-being in our children's lives. And in this session today, we're going to be looking at the impact, particularly of social media, on our children's well-being. And there's a whole chapter on that and just lots of other stuff as well. So love to recommend that one. And then just to say, this is a book, my recent one, it's called Born Free, A Call to Be Still, Know God, and Flourish in a Hectic World. If, like me, you have a bit of an A-type personality, if you are trying to navigate faith in the context of work and family life, how is it that we can find that still, small place? How can we live from that place of centeredness on Jesus in all the things that busyness of life? And this is really my story, some lessons I learned in the pandemic and beyond, and I'm still trying to learn. So recommend that one to you as well. But we're here to talk about parenting in a digital age. And I imagine many here are parents, but there will also be grandparents, there may be carers, foster parents, aunts, uncles, godparents, all kinds of people. And we want to learn how to navigate this digital age with wisdom. So it's interesting, certain dates in history are significant in terms of how we relate together as a society. And one of those dates is 1440. The historians amongst you may know that that was when the printing press was invented. So that changed the way that we could exchange written information. Another key date is 2007. 2007 is when Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone, the smartphone. And suddenly, little computer in our pockets, we can connect with anyone, anywhere, and it opened a wealth of possibility, but many challenges as well. But something else happened in 2007. If you look at the graphs that measure the increase in anxiety and depression amongst a generation of young people, around 2007 are the years that that graph goes in an upward tick. Now, I don't think we can put all the blame at the feet of technology, but common sense dictates there has to be a connection. So we're going to look at that in more detail in a little while, because the phone is not a tool anymore with a curly cord on which you make a call. It is a device that is shaping our lives, shaping our discipleship, shaping our families, shaping our children. Now, yesterday we looked at this verse here from 1 Chronicles 12, verse 32. And Ezra is writing, and he is listing the men who were enlisted to fight for King David against Saul. And he talks about the men of Issachar who knew the times and knew what to do. And that's what we looked at yesterday. We don't just need the information. It's really important that we have the information. But that's not enough. We need to know what to do. We need to have practical tools to help us. That's what we're going to be sharing today. But it's hard. There are many advantages to the digital age. I want to say that at the outset. so many ways that it's part of our lives. There's a professor at the London School of Economics called Sonia Livingstone, and she writes that life is now digital by default. It is part of our lives. It's how we connect with people. It's how we get information. For our teenagers, it's a great way for them to establish their identity. A lot of advantages for children with additional needs. And if you today have a child and that's a concern in your family, certainly contact us at Care for the Family, because we have wonderful support for parents of children with all kinds of additional need. But the digital age can be a real blessing in many ways for that. And if that's your situation, just to say as well, listen up to what I'm saying. The principles remain, but you might just have to work at applying them a little bit differently. So yesterday, we looked at time on screens, and how we can manage that, and the big forces that are out there. Things like the attention economy, the algorithms, the devices themselves, the way they're designed, the slot machine effect, all these forces that combine with the way that our young people's brains are still developing, the teenage brain, and that is why it's so hard to manage, why it's a perfect storm. But there are some bigger challenges heading down the road, and that's the ones we're going to be looking at today. So let's put our seatbelts on for these, because the first one is contact. Who is it that we are connecting with? Who is it that our children are conversing with and building relationships with online? So Charlie is 15, and he says to you that he's just going out to meet somebody that he's met online. And he's called Harry, and he's also 15. And you know that he might not be called Harry, and he might not be 15. And you're concerned. There's the whole issue of grooming. A recent NSPCC report said that grooming has increased by 82% in the last 5 years. And often it's someone pretending to be somebody else. They find out the interests of the child or the young person. They use that to gain their trust and to befriend them and then to take advantage of them. So grooming. And then there are the Instagram influencers. Many of our young people connecting with those influencers and looking to them as role models. And again, there are some good role models out there. It's not all bad. But often they are celebrities who are being paid to promote particular products, often products they have never tried or used themselves. The British Association of Dermatologists mounted a bit of a campaign because they found that these influencers were promoting cosmetics and makeup to young children, young girls in particular. And the products were all packaged in bright packaging with animals on, and just to make it attractive to young people. But the products contained acids and retinol, kind of thing, you know, skin my age needs, not little ones, and it was causing their skin a lot of damage. And there's many, many examples of the kind of things that are being promoted online. And we need to be talking to our children about those and making sure that they know that the influencers probably haven't tried those products and that they are being paid to promote them. There are the thought influencers as well. People like the misogynist Andrew Tate and others who are promoting ideologies that it's very easy to get sucked into online. So that's conduct. Next one also begins with C, and this is conduct. Sorry, that was contact. Next, conduct. How we behave. How our children are behaving, how others are behaving to them online. Yesterday there was a question about bullying. And so let's just look at that for a few minutes. So our child, we realize, has just become more withdrawn. They're in their bedroom a lot more. They've stopped socializing. Maybe their appetite's been affected. And we wonder, are they being bullied. In my day, generally, the bully stayed in the school playground at the end of the school day. But for our children today, the bully follows them home through the smartphone in their pocket, as they get on the bus, as they eat their evening meal, as they do their homework, and as that phone just pings under the duvet at night. It's 24/7 for them. Very often the bullies are anonymous. So 24% of children report being bullied online, 38% of those with additional needs. And a quarter of those who are bullied go on to self-harm. What can we do? What can we do if we think our child is the subject of online bullying? We can spot the signs. We want to give them support. I know we have four adult children, and my daughter says to me that I didn't do well when she was at school and she was getting a bit of bullying, not online, but just in the playground. And I think I just said, oh, you know, just ignore it. And she said afterwards, that was so unhelpful. Nil points for me on parenting for that one. She said it would have been so much better if you'd listened to me, if we talked about it, rather than just dismissing it and saying, you know, you'll be fine. So let's give them the space, listen to their concerns. If they are being bullied, tell them not to reply to the bully. Tell them to block the messages and delete the app, but to continue to be online, because that will be taking away other support and other connections and friendships from them. And then if we are really concerned, and if there's a school, the school will have a bullying policy, we can work with the school as well. And if our child is the bully, that can be a hard one. But again, let's talk about this. Chat to them about the effect of their message. They might just be joining in a WhatsApp chat that suddenly has spiraled out of control. But talk to them about the effect of their behavior, their words, on someone else, the reason for it. Don't condone it, but come alongside and give them support as well. So that's bullying. There is going to be good news at the end of this, but I'm giving you some of the challenges. Heads up. And the next one is sending nudes and sexting. So a recent survey found there's an epidemic now of sending nudes and sending sexual messages, often as a precursor to dating. If they're under 18, it's actually illegal. It's illegal to do that. Let me take you to this little scenario. Little online scenario. So Alice is at home and she's on her phone and she's scrolling through messages, and Carl is in his home and he's scrolling as well, and he sees Alice is online. He messages her and he says, "Hi Alice, I've seen you on the bus. You're in the year below, aren't you?" "Yes." "Alice, you're very pretty." "Thank you." "Alice, just undo the top three buttons on your shirt." And Alice's hand goes to her shirt. She undoes some buttons. She sends a picture over. "Like this?" "No," he says, "a bit more, a bit more." So it begins. A quarter of 12 to 17-year-olds have received unwanted sexual photos or videos. Average age is 14. And the tragic thing of this is half of those don't feel able to talk to their parents about it. The fact that you're here this morning means I expect you are not in that category at all, because you want to have open communication with your children. But this is a big issue. So that's how they behave. And then content. What is it? What are the images that we're seeing? So maybe our child is doing their homework and we come in the room and they switch to another screen and we just wonder, what is it that they have been looking at? You may remember the tragic case a number of years ago now of Molly Russell. She was a young girl who took her own life, and she took it after receiving 16,000 images on Instagram. 16,000 images of self-harm and suicide ideation and those kinds of things. And the tech companies were found to be responsible for her death. And her father, Ian Russell, set up a foundation, and he said that they had monetized her misery. So they can be bombarded, as we saw yesterday, with algorithms giving them unhelpful material, things, misinformation, disinformation, and pornography. So porn now is any time, any place, at a speed and scale that previously we wouldn't have thought possible. Often violent images that will imprint on their minds. The average age of coming across porn is 13. Usually they're not looking for it, but either they're on a computer that hasn't got the right filters, the right protections, or more usually on a friend's house, on a friend's computer. I know our boys all saw porn the first time on a dad's computer at a friend's house. So it's out there, and we need to be talking to them about it, because it's giving them the message that sex is a performance and it's divorced from consent, from faithfulness, from intimacy, from love, from marriage, from commitment, from the beautiful thing that God intended it to be. And we have a better story to tell our children about God's purposes for relationships, for marriage, and for sex. The Song of Songs in the middle of the Bible, the most beautiful love poem. It can be awkward having those conversations. And the best way to do it, as of all these things, is not to have a download as soon as we get out of this seminar, but little by little, using the prompts, using the conversations, finding out what their friends are saying, and keep it as an ongoing conversation in family life. I was talking to a young girl recently who's engaged to be married, and we were talking about her marriage preparation, and she said, "Nobody has talked to me about sex." She said, "I know that on one level, you know, don't do it, and the other level, do it when you're married, but there's nothing." She said, "No one has talked to me about what happens in the middle bit, or about porn, or about anything about it." And so let's be on the front foot with that, because we have such a great and beautiful story to tell. Then there's AI. Now, we dealt a little bit with that yesterday, but AI is software that is performing complex tasks that normally needed human input. And it's given amazing opportunities. But as with all these things, some unforeseen challenges. So there are advantages. We use AI every day. Facial recognition on our phones. I had to get into my emails this morning with my facial recognition. Passport control, we get through that now with AI. Our banking, it recognises every curve and wrinkle in our faces. It's been called the AI bouncer. But keeping our private information safe. It can be a personal research assistant. We can look up a recipe or a book to buy or whatever else. And there are smartphone devices in the home. My husband's greatest gift that was given to him a year ago is a lawnmower that, by the name of Mosley, that is done by his phone. He used to get very stressed about the grass growing when we were away, and now we, from the safety of Keswick, can press a button and our grass can be mown. It's joyous. He's much more excited about this than I am, can I say, but it still happens. Alexa can buy products for us. But there's a warning. So I read a story about a little girl in Texas, and she was 6 years old, and she said, "Alexa, I'm a bit bored. Buy me a doll's house and come and play with me." Well, her bemused parents were a little surprised the next day to find a doll's house being delivered to their front door. That was all very well. The story got onto the local news, and the newsreader then said, there was this girl, and her parents had got Alexa connected to their bank account, and she said, "Alexa, buy me a doll's house and play with me." And everyone, apparently, who had Alexa on while the newsreader was saying this announcement, then had dolls' houses delivered to the door. Beware your settings. But there are clearly challenges as well with AI, because AI can develop realistic content which can present a risk. Tristan Harris was the design ethicist at Google, and he said this, that social media is the first contact. It's curating information, but AI takes it a step up. It's the second contact. It's supercharging, and it's generating material. And that can include AI-generated sexual abuse material, grooming, deepfakes. It can manipulate videos and imitate voices. But it can only reproduce human knowledge. That's the limitation. It can't innovate or generate new ideas. And God has given us brains that can do that. I was doing a podcast for a youth organization recently, and the youth leader said, I tell my youth leaders, use AI to get your games for the year, to sort out the rotas. But by and large, don't get AI to write your talks, because AI is not responsive to the nudge of the Holy Spirit. Now, I happen to think God is even bigger than AI, but the point was well made, that it can only generate what's already there. But because of that, we need to help our children develop this important skill of critical thinking. Let's enable them to be curious, to ask questions. So when they have a bit of information, what is the source? Where did it come from? Does it tally with other things they know to be true? Talk to them about the filter bubble, which basically means that the more they follow one point of view, the echo chamber means that they're more likely to see similar viewpoints. Now, I don't know if you remember, but I think it was last year, the TV presenter Kirsty Allsop made the news because she sent her 16-year-old solo on the Eurostar and railing around Europe, going on a train around Europe, age 16. And there was a lot of hoo-ha about, was this a responsible thing to do? Was she a negligent parent? And I started reading about this, and I think I clicked more on the reports that were saying this was a good thing to do. Our children need risk and adventure. And I said to our son, it's really amazing. Most people seem to think that this was a responsible thing to do. He said, Mum, it's because that's what you're looking at. So they're reproducing those reports to you. If you were looking the other direction and thinking she was a negligent mother, that's what you would be hearing. And I thought, of course, of course. So let's initiate those discussions with our children. Check their settings. Check that they've got good privacy settings, good passwords. A sign of friendship with young people is often to share a password. It's not a good idea. I did hear one Christian organization had done a survey, and 80% of the children had got Jesus as their password. There we go. So that's AI. So those three things, contact, conduct, content, some big, big challenges. And then the one that kind of runs through all those is social media. So let's have a little look at that and how that links with well-being. So there are positives again to social media. It can provide, you know, useful place to link with like-minded people. Vulnerable children can often find others with similar interests online. There are some really healthy forums and other places they can go. But there are many negatives. Ofcom recently reported, it said that social media is becoming less and less social. And I would agree. I mentioned that date, 2007, when the smartphone arrived, changing the graphs, or being linked with the change in the graphs of anxiety and depression amongst young people. Two other significant things impacted that. 2010, Instagram, and the front-facing camera. And this is particularly an issue for girls, but boys as well, other issues. Boys tend to be more gaming and gambling, but it is across the board. And it's interesting that often young people's mental well-being just hits the deck after they go to secondary school, which is very often when they change from little, if they have a phone before then, they're looking at pictures of cats and fun little games, and then it becomes these image-conscious platforms. Now, there's a debate about correlation or causation. Is the phone a direct, is the mental well-being of our children directly attributable to phones? I think not, but I do think, as I said before, common sense says there is an issue. But there's lots that plays into this, and partly it's the selfie culture. Selfie culture is encouraging our young people to create a very polished, shiny image of themselves online. They have an online identity that often bears no relation to real life, and they know that. And then even if they get lots of likes on their online identity, they know they can't live up to it. And so that fuels anxiety. Teenage years are often a time when peer approval is so important. It's been said peer approval is the oxygen of adolescence. And it's the first generation to have a number allocated to their worth, the number of likes they have on social media. But yet again, we have a better story to tell them. We can tell them they don't have to create an online identity that they have to live up to, because they are loved and they are known for who they are by us and by their Heavenly Father. But this pressure is impacting their mental well-being. And many young people are suffering anxiety and depression. I used to hate it when our children got stuck into those downward spirals of negativity, when they were catastrophizing, seeing the worst. And maybe you see that in some of your children. But it doesn't have to be like that. Because the way that God has created our brains, something called the plasticity of the brain, which means that it can change. And we've put this little video together. Have a look at this. This is how the brain works.
Our brains are incredible. We can remember things we've previously learned, and we can learn new skills. But did you know we can also change ingrained habits and behaviors? Imagine you've been regularly walking down a familiar pathway in a forest, but now you want to change direction, so you try to form a new pathway. Everywhere you turn, there are branches and weeds blocking your way and brambles tugging at your clothing. Getting through that forest is hard work, but you make it. You leave behind a few flattened weeds and some trampled bushes. The next day, you walk along that new path again, only this time it's slightly easier to cross, because you began to forge that pathway yesterday. Day after day, you continue to cross that same forest until eventually there is a clear route through. The branches and weeds are truly trampled and the brambles are cut back, and the way is clear. Now, walking through this forest becomes simple, painless, and perhaps even enjoyable. And if you ever had to go that way again, you'd automatically choose the new pathway you've created. It's now the best route to take. And now, the old pathway has become overgrown. In the same way, our brains look for paths to follow. When we come to a scenario we've previously encountered, our brain looks for the easiest pathway, a route we've previously taken before. Maybe a thought process we've had many times, or a skill we've learned through repetition. Our brain naturally finds the most well-worn path and takes that route. But instead of taking the old paths, our brains can in fact be retrained to do new things or do things differently. It can be hard work, and more so for adults, because we've been treading down those paths for years, even decades. This can cause us to have anxieties. But we can learn new skills. We can overcome negative thought patterns. And we can even learn to relate to people differently. It is possible to change our habits. Our brains truly are incredible.
Our brains are amazing. And I love it that when I was researching the book, A Mind of Their Own, how much was reflected, well, how much of the Bible was reflected in the science. You know, in Romans, we read, don't conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That's how God has created the brain. And in that respect, we have everything to play for with our children, because if they're getting sucked into these negative ways of thinking through spending time on social media or whatever messages they're receiving, particularly through technology, we have the opportunity to help them to forge those different pathways. So here's a little story that illustrates it. Livy and Maria are doing what they love doing on a Saturday afternoon. They're in town, they're trying on clothes, taking selfies, posting them on social media. And they have a look in the evening, and as they're just getting back home, they've got quite a few likes. Livy's heading off to bed, and she checks her phone again, and she's got even more likes, and she feels pleased. And then she sees someone's made a comment. They've put that she's got scrawny arms. And she thinks, yeah, I do have scrawny arms. I don't work out enough. I'm so ugly. I'll never have any friends. And soon, the joy of the day has been taken away by that online comment. Well, at the same time, Maria is heading off to bed, and she checks her phone. She's got more likes as well. And then she notices a comment, and someone's put she better do something about her fat tummy. And she feels really sad. But then she remembers conversations with her mum, with her dad. She remembers when she didn't do so well in the exam and her dad enabled her to think differently. She remembered how the youth leader had helped her to rise above a comment that was made on the bus on the way home last week. And she thinks, no, I am not going to just be defined by that unkind comment. I love my top. It suits me. It's a great color. It was a bargain. And I don't have to be defined by other people's opinions of myself. No. And she's able to begin. It doesn't happen overnight, but able to begin to think differently. And we can help our children do that. We looked yesterday at Philippians 4. Whatever is true, whatever is lovely, whatever is honorable, can help them think about such things. So what can we do? Here are a few things we can do to help manage all this challenge. And the first one is just a really practical little thing that we can do in terms of our helping our children with their thinking. It's called blue to true thinking. And all we do is this. If we catch them catastrophizing or going down in a negative spiral, we get them to either pop it on their phone or write it down in a notebook, that negative thought. Then we challenge it. We say, no, that is not the truth. Here is the truth, and we get them to write that down or pop it on their phone. And then when those negative thoughts return, we have the truth to come back to. They have it to come back to. It's how you catch, challenge, and then change negative thought patterns. We can get them to unfollow people who are provoking anxiety and comparison, and follow good, wholesome content that brings life. One family we know, they've got a jar, and they call it the turn-off tune-in jam jar, and they've just got the kids to put in lots of ideas of things they can do, put the phones away, fun things they can do together as a family, and every now and then they pull one out and they do it. Keep the devices out of sight. It's so easy if they're just on the table, just to pick it up in a moment of boredom. But boredom can be an amazing place for creativity and new thinking and fun and adventure. So if we keep the devices out of sight when we're not using them, then that can really help, not just grab them by default. Encourage walks, encourage board games, encourage fun activities that are not anything to do with technology. We looked yesterday at ways we can use technology, but let's have tech-free time as well. Jonathan Haidt, in his book, The Anxious Generation, he says we have underprotected our children online and overprotected them in the real world. And I think that is right. We have a little bunch of grandchildren, but four live on an organic farm in Somerset, and they are fairly, well, I think they have quite a lot of risk just by living in that situation. But last Christmas, we had all the family there, and we got some little girl grandchildren who were being given, you know, fairy wings and a whole Disney pink, fluffy, glittery thing going on there. And to my amazement, five-year-old Ezra, who lives on the farm, opens a toolbox, but a genuine toolbox, not a kid's one. There was a saw, and there was a hammer, and there was... I think, what are they thinking? But, you know, they are thinking well. They're teaching him to use it well. Of course it's risky. Of course he can hurt himself. But actually, he's learning. He's learning to manage that risk, even at five. Maybe you could think of one thing your child could do that they've never done before. Maybe you could just drive to the shop, wait outside, give them the money, send them in, bring them out, and they can do that by themselves. Maybe they could do a whole errand, just gradually extending those boundaries, giving them more responsibility, helping them take those risks while we're there, and not when it's too late and we're not there. Well, it's never too late, but not when we're not there to pick up the pieces. Helping them, you know your child, you know the risks that they can manage, but always thinking ahead, because sometimes playing safe is dangerous. And then other things that we can do. So we can put in safety nets. This is really important. When our children are little, we put the bleach up high, we put the sharp knives out of reach. We can put safety nets in place by using technology, using the PEGI, the PEGI, the ratings. We can put filters in place to limit time, to limit content. And if you don't know how to do that, in the back of Left Their Own Devices, there's a glossary. There's just lots of help available from providers on how to put those things in place. Ask other parents what things they found that work. The good news is the government are onto this. And just this last week, the Online Safety Act brought in much stricter age verification and content filters. And that is good. But you know, most savvy teenagers will be able to get around some of those things. So the home is where it matters. And one of the things, my top tip, would be to create what we call a family media agreement. You don't need to grab it now, but in your bag, you will have had a little leaflet. And this is what we've put together to describe how you can put, it's a little pro forma, how to create a family media agreement for your family. And all this means is that you get together with your family, doesn't matter what size or shape, parenting alone, parenting together, teenagers, little ones, everybody, you get some snacks, you get some drinks, make it a really fun thing to do, and you talk together about what your boundaries are for use of technology in the home. And even the most uncommunicative teenager will take part if they think they're going to be listened to, if they have skin in the game. And the deal is everybody signs up to this, even the parents. It needs to be age appropriate, so what's appropriate for a 6-year-old will be different than a 16-year-old. We're thinking about what we can do, not just a list of don'ts, and what the consequences are if someone sneaks across the line. But the world's your oyster. You could talk about where and when you use technology. Do you allow it in the bedroom? Do you allow it at the meal table? One thing, if at all possible, I would say, get the phones out of the bedroom at night. If you have a 16-year-old and they already sleep with their phone by their bed, it's probably too hard to unwind that, and it's not about going on a guilt trip. But if they're younger, don't have those phones there. They don't need them whirring around their heads all night. And then you could talk about when they get their first smartphone in terms of what do they need it for. And we talked yesterday about the smartphone-free childhood and a movement to delay the smartphone. Do they need a phone so they can let you know they're on the bus on the way home from school? If so, they probably don't need a mini computer in their pocket. They need a phone. And if you look on the Smartphone Free Child website, there's a lot of information about cool-looking phones that are phones. Wise phones, dumb phones, flip phones. They do the job of being able to make calls, but they don't have access to the internet. So have a decision in your family, according to your values, when do you get the smartphone? This isn't about making their world smaller, but this is about putting good, secure boundaries in place. If you think that's how God parents us, he doesn't take away our choices. He doesn't limit our freedom. He wants to give us wisdom to make good choices in a world where any choice is possible. So this isn't about a straitjacket. It's a seatbelt to keep everybody safe. But even then, your phone can be a digital Fort Knox. But even then, there will be times when they're in a different public place, that have friends with phones that don't have the same protections on that you have. They'll be on public Wi-Fi. What then? Our job as parents isn't to raise children, and it's not even to raise teenagers. It's to raise adults who can make wise choices when any choice is possible. And unless we are helping them with that, they'll only be as safe as the least protected child that they know. So little by little, we want to be feeding in those moments where we can contribute in everyday life. Time spent together, little conversations on the way to school, but putting in and sowing seeds of wisdom in their lives. There's a lovely proverb, and it says this: do not forsake wisdom, and she will protect you. Love her, and she will watch over you. That's what we want for our children. And that they too, in time, like the men of Issachar, not just us, but they will know what to do, what the times are, and what to do. Let me, as we will have some questions now, but let me just take you back to that online scene. Do you remember Alice and Carl? So Alice is on her phone, Carl's on his, and Alice notices that he's online. He messages her, "Alice, I've seen you on the bus. You're in the year below, aren't you?" "Yes." "Alice, you're very pretty." "Thank you." "Alice, can you just undo the top three buttons on your shirt?" Alice's hand goes to her shirt. But in that moment, she remembers. She remembers all those family times, the conversations with her mom, with her dad. She remembers she's loved unconditionally. She remembers she has to prove herself to nobody. Alice takes her hand away from her shirt and says, "No." That's what we're playing for the boys every bit as much as the girls, to make those wise choices and to use technology for good. Let's have some questions now. And I would be happy to answer them. Sarah has a microphone. And there we go.
One of the kind of methods some parents are doing, I think, is having saying, we've got a phone that the child can use if they're going out and need it, and it is like a family phone. Or the idea of, as you said, don't have phones in the bedrooms, they're kept and they're monitored and they're checked by parents. But at what point do we cross over that boundary of allowing our children to have their freedom and their independence? And, you know, is it wrong for us to be looking through their messages and kind of checking what they're up to?
Great question. So I'm sure everyone heard it, but how do we manage allowing them to have that freedom eventually? When should we be checking their phone? When can they have their own phone? I would say, number one, you know your child best. You love them the most. You know their maturity, and that's the key. What I wouldn't think is a good idea is suddenly at 18, they're given a phone, not having had it before. I talk about something called parenting with elastic. So as parents, we want to keep our children safe, and it's like we keep them on this tight bit of string. But when they seek their independence, that string will go taut and snap. So instead, if we use elastic, we allow them more responsibility gradually as they get older. And then that makes that process to independence easier for them, easier for us. So I would say do it gradually. Do it in conversation. I think when they're little, it's entirely appropriate, number one, to start with no phone or a family phone, and then when they have a phone, to check their messages, but for them to know that you're going to be doing that, and then maybe you know, you allow them a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more, but doing it gradually and in the context of conversation. Yeah.
Thanks so much. Any wisdom for sort of as you're sort of helping your eldest child navigate tech, how to help the younger ones? Because it sort of feels like you set a boundary for the oldest one, but it sort of very quickly becomes what the younger one has and expects. So, yeah, any wisdom on that?
So hard. Yes, with four children, they always felt the younger one had a much better deal because we were more relaxed, and I think most parents are. I think finding things for the older one that only they can do, that you talk to them about, you can do this because you are 15, but actually you are 6, so that is not appropriate. So again, being clear about what those things are, inevitably the 6-year-old will be doing stuff that you probably didn't let the older one do at 6, but technology is changing as well. So the most important thing is keeping the conversation going, and I personally think it's fine to have different rules for both, different ground rules for both.
Hi, thank you. I have a 6-year-old daughter with additional needs, and screens are something that she finds safety in. Like, it really calms her, it switches her brain off to an extent. It's very, very tempting when the rest of life for her is chaos and often violent, to not just put a screen in front of her. Especially, like, and in her background, she came to us basically addicted to screens. Have you got any advice for how to manage that? Because we've been very strict with our elder daughter, but this little one is coming with a different context. Have you got any? Please help.
Absolutely. Well, number one, I would say do contact us at Care for the Family. On the bags that you have, there's a QR code. Do go onto that, and you can access all the help and support that we have, including details of our tours. So do that. And we have additional needs support, so do give them a call there. But for now, I would say it's entire, again, a bit like the previous question, different children have different needs. It's entirely appropriate for different, it's a different situation than it is with your older child. And I think maybe looking at things like how is she after she's been on the screens for that amount of time, if she's calmer and it's been a good thing for her, then that's probably a good thing. But if it's just increased the anxiety, then maybe not. Probably I'd look at what she's watching as much as the time. And I don't know if you've got other friends. I mean, each child is different, but if you've got other friends who are in that kind of space, whether you could talk to them about it. And I think also just monitoring the time. So it's very easy to be watching YouTube and then it's gone on to something else and something else and something else, and suddenly the time's gone away and we don't realise how long they've been on a screen. So, yeah, that's a kind of couple of thoughts, but please do give us a call.
Thank you. Looking back now, what would you do differently to protect your sons from seeing porn at other people's houses or friends' phones? Because, you know, you only have to see it once for it to have potentially impact for years. Is there anything we can do, or what would your advice be?
That's a good one. There was so much I would do different parenting. I'd probably just make different mistakes, though. I think my default was to make their world too small because I was worried about what they were seeing, but then the porn got through. I think you can't prevent it. You can't prevent, unless we keep them just enclosed in our house and never going to see anybody or do anything, then they are going to be coming across this stuff. So I think number one is talking to them about it and preparing them for it, which I didn't do. And so they know that it's not a good thing to do. And if they it's hard, but if they have the confidence to say that in that situation, giving them some get outs. Have one friend, and she said to her child, if you ever get in a difficult situation, you just ring me with this code. It was a code. And then the mum would ring and say, we need to take the granny to hospital or something, or whatever. I don't know what it was, but and she would come and get them. So giving them a get out, I think, is good if they're in that situation. Talking to them about different families, different values. One, friends we have who were ministering in a very vulnerable area ended up, because of the families that were around them, had very different values to them. They ended up mainly inviting friends back to their house because of that very particular situation. But I actually think it's good for our children to see that families do things differently as well. So we can't protect them from much as we would like to from everything. So talking about it, giving them a get out, and being a little bit wise about where they go and what they do, I would say.
Hello. As a dad in my 20s, so sort of one of the first generations who are having children and have experienced the kind of the harms and the risks of the online space, and having parents who didn't know about all of this thing, and so being kind of thrust into all of that and the risks and the harm that came from that, is it wise for me to talk to our children in the light of that and open up about my own experiences and the mistakes that I made? Or is it wise for me to talk from a more third-person perspective to not validate the mistakes that I made and the things that I did?
I think, and say
that I'm kind of redeemed, and so it's okay for you to do that too.
Are you concerned about putting your parents in a bad light?
I'm concerned that my children will kind of, if I open up about the mistakes that I made, they will think it's okay for them to make those same mistakes.
Yeah. No, well, I think it depends on your relationship with your child, but I would think actually it's fine to say them, because it's honest. I don't think we want to talk about all our failures all the time, but there's something very powerful in finding that our parents actually do have feet of clay. But I think if you were able to talk about whatever the mistakes were and the regret, the consequence, whatever it was, why it wasn't a good thing, I think that generally, depending on, you know, your child best and what they can manage and how old they are, but I would say that's a good thing. In The Mind of Their Own book, I talk about, there's a whole chapter on failure and us being honest about our own failures. And one of the ideas is have something called Failure Friday. So on a Friday, every now and then, you have a meal and you talk about, inventions that were things that were discovered through failure, and then actually talk about our own failure as well, because that's real and it's vulnerable. But probably I don't know what the particular issues are, but you know your child and there may be some limits on that as well. But what can you learn from it would be the focus. Yeah.
Thank you. How would you explain the dangers to a particularly anxious child? So someone who is already terrified of the world, how would you explain those dangers that could be an issue?
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Because what we don't want to do is increase anxiety. Again, there's some stuff in A Mind of Their Own about that. I think just managing it a little step at a time and helping them with it. So this is a very silly example, but just say they were very anxious about traveling to school, say, on the bus. That's a silly example, but go with that one for now. And so what you wouldn't do is day one, off you go. You'd say, right, day one, let's talk about this. This is what it's going to be like. Let me come with you. So we go on the bus and let me come back. And then maybe a bit later, okay, we'll go with you, and then we'll put you on the bus and you come back on your own. And then next they do it on their own. So I think gradually allowing them to take risk and responsibility, but also they do need to have a little bit of idea of what the dangers are. But again, we don't need to do the whole thing, little and often, for these things. We used to do a fun thing with our children. So four of them, they're all quite different, but we didn't have much one-on-one time for those conversations. And so we decided that one of us would take one of them out to breakfast on a Saturday morning to Tesco's. And they could choose which one of us they wanted to go with. Well, this had been going on for some time, and I found I didn't get to go. And I thought, am I just not a fun mum? What's going on? And I discovered when I took them, they had Weetabix and smoothies and orange juice. When Richard took them, they appeared to be having cheesy Watsits, chocolate eclairs and Coca-Cola. Of course they wanted to go with him. It was much more fun. And it wasn't about healthy eating, although I'm all for healthy eating. Anyway, those moments were incredibly important in just having that opportunity. Their agenda, is there something worrying you? How can we help you with it? And then having, if there's a youth leader or mentors, or having other people in our children's lives, a grandparent, to just help navigate little bit by little bit, if that's helpful.
Hiya, thank you so much for all you've said. I'm a youth worker and I'm just looking for resources, especially at that drop-off point when they turn 18, head off to uni, and maybe they've not had any experience of kind of online world or how to interact with it outside a kind of a very restricted household. So do you know any resources, any books that look at kind of that first year of uni when suddenly the world's their oyster and there's lots of freedom?
Do you know, I don't know any that are specific to that. I mean, the general principles, there's lots of websites, things like Internet Matters, Parent Zone. There's a list at the back of the book. I don't know anything, but if you ring us at Care for the Family, we could have a look for that for you and let you know.
Hi, thanks very much. My two older kids are both quite into Duolingo and do it kind of quite enthusiastically, basically. And my question is there anything that's digital that you think is just kind of harmless and innocent and you'd happily just leave your kid to do it for a couple of hours sort of thing? Or do you think that whole idea is just mad and you should only allow them on a phone for like 20 minutes a day or something?
No, I would say it's much more about what they're doing than the length of time they're doing it for, 100%. Duolingo is a great idea. And there's lots of fun things that you can do together as a family as well. I'm trying to think the name. Big Potato, is it? I'm trying to remember. But the games you can do, online games as well. We've got friends that do that as a sort of family night. But I would look much more at, you know, is it leisure? Is it learning? What are they using it for? Because screen time isn't the same. What language are they learning?
French.
My goodness, well, did you hear that? French, German, Latin, Japanese. I mean, that's fantastic.
Hi, Catherine. Sometimes I've wondered about ditching the smartphone because it can be so addictive to my husband and I. And you mentioned not dropping our kids at the deep end at 18 with no previous training, experience, and oversight. Do you think there's any argument, my oldest is 13, to them not having a smartphone at all and kind of walking them through that decision and kind of suggesting that as an alternative?
Yeah, I think, I think each family is different and each child is different. And so you know their maturity. I definitely think delay as long as possible. Jonathan Haidt in The Anxious Generation and the Smartphone-Free Childhood, say 14 for a smartphone, 16 for social media. I think the issue isn't so much the smartphone, but it's what it leads to. Mm. So it may be that, okay, they do have a smartphone, but no social media, or you limit, you know, what other content can be on that. So I think at some stage, they're going to be independent and they need to have at least some experience of technology, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be the smartphone straight off.
Okay. Hi, thank you so much. I think this might be obvious for lots of people, but our challenge we found is teenagers and how to have like downtime in the home that doesn't involve screens. I think we found when they're younger, it's easier because you can get the toys out and the trains out and the Lego. But as teenagers, that's been more of a challenge. Have you got any advice around that? Thank you.
That's a really good question. There may be other people that are better equipped than me to answer that one, but I would say, what are they interested in? Are there things that they're interested in? So in the same way that, I don't know what their interests are, but sport, or, and it might involve us going the extra mile to create the fun thing, doing fun sort of family nights when you have a theme, you know, cooking, or we used to do this fun thing and we'd have a different, never got the Japanese, but we'd do different themes for the food. And so they'd help cook, doing kind of the stuff around the house, board games. Sounds a bit lame, doesn't it? That's the trouble, because they want the risk and adventure. But I would say that, I don't know if the boys or girls, but the sort of more sporty outdoor stuff, and just, yeah, creating. And sometimes boredom is the place of creativity, it really is. So giving them that opportunity for that. But if anyone else has any better examples, see this lady after. Wonderful. Well, thank you so very much for coming to these sessions. We would love to support you at Care for the Family. Do sign up on our QR code, and that would be brilliant. Shall I just pray as we end? Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are the God who loves us, who loves our children, who has the best plan for family life. And Lord, we pray that you would help us to put those good, secure boundaries in place, that you'd help us to make the most of technology, and most of all, that our children would learn the wisdom of heaven, so that they know they're loved unconditionally by you, by us, and they know how to make those really good choices. Help them to look at all the things that are lovely and true and honourable and of good report, and shape their characters so they and us become more like you, we pray. In Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Thanks again.